Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. If you've ever gone scuba diving, snorkeling, or even submerged yourself in a swimming pool, you probably don't remember much, if any, sound. And anything you did hear was likely muffled. Based on those limited underwater experiences, generations of humans made the assumption that the oceans were silent. We now know the underwater environment is rich with sound. In a moment, we discuss the pioneering work of William Watkins, who opened our ears to the ocean. But first, we hear a research ecologist at NOAA who spent a month at sea trying to capture the sound of one of the most elusive whales in the Atlantic Ocean. Brendan Tenney has the story.
200 miles off the coast of Cape Cod. It's a calm, sunny day at sea. Up on the ship's bridge, scientists are facing out with binoculars, looking in all directions. Below deck, their teammates listen to a series of underwater microphones being towed behind them. Everyone is on high alert. The chief scientist stands on the deck of the Gordon Gunter, waiting for good news.
My name is Danielle Chalowick. I'm a research ecologist at Northeast Fisheries Science Center. I study the ecology and distribution and behavior of marine mammals.
But when she's at a party, she says...
Yeah, that's sort of mouthful. I just say I study whale sounds.
Chalowick is an expert in listening to whales and interpreting their sounds. A few years ago, she became focused on finding and recording this one mythically rare whale, the true-beaked whale. The true-beaked whale was first discovered stranded on a beach in 1913.
And a man by the name of Frederick True went and took a look at it and recognized it as a new species and gave it a name.
In the subsequent 100-plus years, they've only been seen a handful of times. We know almost nothing about them. They're actually considered data deficient by the scientific community.
That means that we aren't really prepared to do proper conservation and management.
Did you catch that? Researchers know so little about this whale that they don't even know how to protect it. Chalowick wanted to change that. So this past summer, she set out to find the true-beaked whale and learn as much about their sounds and behavior as possible. She assembled a team of the best scientists she could find for a month-long whale search.
We covered hundreds and hundreds of miles.
They scanned the horizon, listening to their underwater mics round the clock.
One day, seas were pretty rough. We weren't expecting to see anything. And a true-beaked whale popped up right next to the boat. And everybody who saw it was so excited. We're like, okay, they're here, yes.
At last, they could now zero in on a reliable gathering place to find them.
It's an incredible feeling.
Yeah,
it's really fantastic.
But that was just step one. Chalowick wanted to get close enough to attach some D-tags to the whales.
Which are digital suction cup recording tags.
To pull it off, her team tracked a group of whales and deployed a small boat to chase after them. Her colleague Lee stood on the bow of the small boat, holding a long pole with the D-tag on the end of it. He needed to pop it on without scaring the whales away.
And that's really hard to do because they don't really want the boat that close.
They tried for over 4 hours, and Lee had already missed the whales twice.
So we're calling the boat, and we're saying the whales are up, they're half a mile off your port side, and one beaked whale popped up right next to them, and Lee leaned over, he got on his tiptoes, he leaned over, and he just popped the tag on. Everybody just screamed. The whole ship erupted.
The D-tags stayed on the whale for 12 hours, recording extremely detailed audio and foraging behavior.
We all recognized that this was a little piece of science history being made because now we were going to collect some information on the species that we had never collected before. The first time I heard this, it almost made me cry. These are the sounds that this animal was making that were recorded right on his body, and it just was so personal and so intimate. It really choked me up.
If you could tell the whales anything...
I would say, don't be so shy. We just want to learn more about you. Make it a little easier for us.
Unfortunately, they probably won't make it easier for Danielle Chalowick anytime soon. It is a chase, after all. but it's a chase she's more than ready for.
So much more work needs to be done. We're just scratching the surface.
In Woods Hole, Massachusetts, I'm Brandon Tenney.
The technology used by NOAA and other researchers to study the sounds and behaviors of marine mammals was pioneered by William Watkins, an engineer and oceanographer who spent decades at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Joining us to talk about his early work and its impact on marine mammal conservation is Captain Bob Wallace, who ran the research vessel Able J, a platform of which much of Bill Watkins' early work. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us is Peter Tyak, scientist emeritus in the biology department at HUI, who studies social behavior and acoustic communication in marine mammals. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
So Bill Watkins is credited with designing and building some of the first underwater recording instrumentation. And his background wasn't in science, but radio. Peter, tell us a little bit more about his background and why his focus shifted to underwater recordings.
Yes, part of what Bill started doing was trying to develop radio stations in Western Africa where it was quite difficult to operate transmitters. And this was the era of the vacuum tube. And he learned how to operate transmitters with transistors, which were much better adapted for work under tough conditions. And Bill Chaville, who was working at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution at that time, recognized that Watkins' skills might offer an opportunity to be able to build recorders that you could actually take to sea. Previously, he had made recordings from dictaphones in the St. Lawrence. That was one of some of the most early pioneering work. He worked with the Navy, and they did direct-to-disc recording on vinyl LPs. But this took a 100-meter ship. It was very difficult to do. And Watkins really pioneered the first recorder called a rowboat recorder, which allowed you to go to sea in a reasonable-sized vessel and make recordings of marine life in their own environment. Mm.
So he built the first tape recorder capable of recording marine mammals at sea. What were some of the challenges to designing and building this device?
We're talking late 50s, so basically you have to go from racks of equipment, which people were used to putting on naval vessels or oceanographic.
Big.
Huge racks of instrumentation, and just completely change your whole mindset. Nowadays, when we think of small digital recording equipment, it's obvious. But in 1960, the idea that you could take a recording studio and compress it into a suitcase-sized object to take to sea was really revolutionary.
Yeah. Bob, you were captain. Oh, go ahead.
I think there's a whole back. I don't know. We don't have enough time, I know. But there's a whole backstory to Bill, in particular. I didn't know Bill Chaville, but Bill Watkins. You know where he came from and the environment in which he lived with the languages that he was surrounded by. He got himself into a very unusual position of being one of the very few people who understood all the regional dialects, and you know. There may have been hundreds, and that there was something about Bill's brain that allowed him to recognize very languages in a way that my brain doesn't work. And the best example I can give you about how I saw that was that he would come on board the ship, and I might have a Portuguese or a French cook or a crew that spoke other languages. Bill would come onto the boat, introduce himself, and immediately start conversing with my crew in their language.
Wow, that's amazing.
So he had this gift, and it traveled over, I think, into what he recognized in the animal sounds.
So you were captain of the Able J, a research vessel that Bill used to find and record whales. The Able J was one of several research vessels owned by the Kendall family. Explain the Kendall family's interest in whale research and how common is it for private individuals to own and operate research vessels at that time?
Well, you're right. I don't think it was very common, mostly because of the level of interest required and the cost of it. But I think the family, the Kendall family, very early on, you know, from the Kendalls that I know, the stories I hear about their family, their father especially, they were instilled with the idea that there was a social responsibility to give back, to support philanthropy in various ways. And I think for the family in the last generation anyway, one of their great interests was in science. And so being sailors and growing up around the water, They took that further to have an interest in going off to the ends of the earth, and in order to do that, you had to have boats that could support that.
Yeah. The ABLE-J was built specifically as a platform for scientific research. So aside from acoustic recording work of Bill Watkins, what other research expeditions did she host?
We did a lot of whale work because of the special characteristics of the ABLE-J in particular. But because of her long range, we could travel. We could leave New Bedford and steam directly to the Falkland Islands and then on to Antarctica and spend a season down there. Mm-hmm. So we supported a number of film projects and other research projects as far away as Northern Europe, around the British Isles, Greenland, Antarctica.
So how large was or is the ABLE-J? Is she still operating?
Not operating, but she still exists up in Norway at the moment. 108 feet, 450 tons, a lot of fuel.
Yeah, expensive. So you worked with Bill Watkins to modify the ABLE-J to be a better platform for underwater recording. Explain how that was accomplished.
Well, she wasn't modified. She was actually designed from the ground up in part to support Bill's work. The owners had we had some experience working with Bill on earlier boats, the predecessors to the ABLE-J. And so Bill was asked what specifically we might include in the design of the new boat that would be useful to him. Mm-hmm. So that included the platforms up high on the boat so you could have observers up high. And noise reduction of the machinery and an ability to actually completely shut the boat down and keep everything running at the same time. Mm. So a lot of it was about noise.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned you've traveled all over with the ABLE-J and Bill Watkins. But how did you, as we heard in that piece, finding the whales isn't always that easy. How did you find the whales or other species that you were looking for?
Well, Peter can talk about this, but there's a number of ways. One is to go to the place where you used to see them. Another is to have people up high with binoculars looking around. But Bill also had a system of hydrophones that we would deploy. Peter can explain how that worked.
Yeah, so animals like sperm whales that make relatively loud sounds that you can hear at 10 kilometers away, you might sight them first by blowing, but when the weather's bad, that would be difficult. And by deploying hydrophones, you can often listen for the sounds of the species you're looking for when you know what they make, and then be able to find them. You stop, wait until you can see, and then both watch and record at the same time. But part of this work is also exploratory. So you heard about the beaked whale sounds. Mm-hmm. They didn't know exactly what sounds they'd make, and there you often have to rely on listening for the unknown and looking for animals that are quite difficult to see.
So Bill developed methods to locate marine mammals, and was it mostly the hydrophones, or did he have other methods or techniques?
The hydrophones are critical for this. He had developed a system that you could deploy an underwater microphone or hydrophone from the bow, one off the stern, and then one that, if the ship blew in the wind, would go off to the side, and you could make sort of a triangle. And then there was a deep hydrophone from one of these, and that allowed you to time the arrival of sounds at all four hydrophones and then locate where the sound came from. And again, we have to put ourselves in the early 70s. That meant you had to use an oscilloscope to measure time delays, punch them into computer cards in order to get the location. Nowadays, you run it off a laptop. It's very easy.
Wow. He sounds like an absolutely brilliant man. I mean, just to thinking of, you talk about the language and just, he had a brain that seemed to work like no one else's.
Yes, and another area here that I think is very important was the ability to track whales over long time periods. And Bill Watkins and Bill Chaville developed these tags that you could use to track whales as well. Mm-hmm. And they used those to follow animals over many days at a time, and that was really quite difficult to do.
But was the ABLE-J equipped with a smaller boat or for getting like closer to animals to record, or were the recordings all done right off of the big ABLE-J?
Well, she was equipped with smaller boats that we would deploy for other missions, but not so much for Watkins' work. I think the term we used was applying the tags via a launcher on the boat. We'd get the ABLE-J up close enough, in this case, to sperm whales. Mm-hmm. For the tagger to do his work. These tags were invasive back in those days. They're not, they've certainly evolved far away from that now. Well, go on to the next question.
We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the pioneer work of William Watkins, who opened our ears to the ocean. In studio with us is Captain Bob Wallace, who ran the research vessel Able J, a platform for much of Bill Watkins' early work, and Peter Tyack, scientist emeritus in the biology department at HUI, who studies social behavior and acoustic communication in marine mammals. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about tagging, and Peter, Bob mentioned it was invasive back then. So talk a little bit about that evolution and what's happened with the tagging technology.
Yes, so early work on tags focused on broad ecological questions. Where did whales migrate? And in fact, the earliest use of this was tags during the whaling era that were shot into whales and only recovered after a whale was killed and dissected on the ship. They then moved to less invasive radio tags, which would actually implant in the animal and then stay on the animal for months at a time and allow people to track the animal from that. Nowadays, we actually use suction cup attached tags, like we heard in the beginning of this section, in which the tag is attached to an animal non-invasively. It actually records the sound on the animal. So it's like having sort of a waterproof iPhone on the animal recording its sounds directly. It then pops off, and then we can get the animal's sounds and behavior directly, as you heard Danielle listening to.
Yeah.
So we've moved from the whaling era to less invasive but invasive tags to not completely non-invasive methods, where the only invasion is coming up, invading the animal's privacy by coming up in that small boat.
Right. And we talked about finding them. Bill also developed methods to identify and follow individual animals, right? So, Peter, what were some of the methods? And then, Bob, do you remember how we employed any of that?
Well, there was a very early era in the 1950s when right whales were relatively commonly sighted off Martha's Vineyard. So the HUI scientists, Dick Backus, Bill Chaville, and Watkins, would go off the from Woods Hole to the vineyard, and they noticed that some of the animals had distinctive markings. So they picked up, you could look at natural markings on animals, not having to put tags or marks on them and track them that way. And that formed a basis of most long-term studies of identified individual marine mammals. They're very important.
Well, I'd like to add, there's an aspect of this that was important, and it's a problem that researchers have everywhere, is where do you get the money?
Of course, yeah.
You know, where do you get the funding to pursue the research? And I think that a lot of, and at least some of, the work that Bill did was financed by the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason I know about that is because I was a submariner. I was in one of those nuke submarines running around under the ocean back in the 60s and 70s. And in sonar, I wasn't in sonar, but in sonar there was always a problem of what we call biologics. And biologics was the background noise. We were listening for mechanical noises, you know, other submarines in particular. And I think that part of Bill's funding, it came from our U.S. Navy with the idea that if he could identify the biological sounds, then they would be able to, in a way, subtract those sounds from the sonar noises that they received on submarines. Now, do you remember that?
Well, they're very important signals in the ocean. We can even go back earlier than that. In World War II, HUI scientists in the 30s had been very important in starting to understand ocean science in the U.S. in general. And the Navy then tapped them to help them solve practical problems during World War II. And Bill Chaville and Alan Vine worked out a system where you could put bathythermographs, or an instrument that measures temperature with depth, on submarines, so they could trim their ballast where there was a thermocline and then be stable for long periods of time so they couldn't be found. They wouldn't have to make sounds. During those periods, Bill Chaville hung around the sonar shack and heard all of these sounds that nobody understood. And I would really track the birth of marine mammal bioacoustics to Bill Chaville on submarines during World War II, training sailors how to stay safe and had developing this intellectual curiosity. And the captains on the ships at that point became admirals after the war and asked people like Chaville and Alan Vine, what are you interested in? Alan Vine built the Alvin, and Bill Chaville developed marine mammal bioacoustics.
So now sound travels through water differently than it does through air, Peter. So talk about how sound travels through the water and how temperature and salinity impact that travel.
Yes, low-frequency sound especially can travel very long distances in the ocean, actually thousands of kilometers. We're very visual animals, so we think of vision as our distant sense. sound is the distant sense in the ocean. That's why the submariners care about it. That's why Bob brought that up. So when sound is moving from, say, a vocalizing animal deep in the open ocean, as the sound ray travels up and the water gets warmer, it refracts downwards. And as it goes downward and the pressure increases, it can refract back up. And that means you can get a path with very low loss where the sound just continues to travel over hundreds and even thousands of kilometers and be detectable at great ranges. So this is something that again, the navies of the world have taken advantage of and care a lot about. But whales got there first. For tens of millions of years, whales have evolved communication systems to take advantage of the unique physics of sound in the ocean.
There's an archive of recordings that Bill Watkins made. Tell us a little bit about the size and significance of this archive.
Yes. So this is very important that both Bill Scheville and Watkins, as they made recordings, would store them in whatever media they were on. So the first recordings we have are on a dictaphone. There are some on vinyl LP. There are all sorts of instrumentation tape recordings. And these were digitized. Bill Watkins had a strong desire to make sure that these were converted to a format that would be available to people in the modern world.
Yeah, really, and now there's thought ahead.
Exactly. So now there's a digital database of these sounds that any listener is interested in can go find on the HUI website and be able to then search for sounds of different animals. And this includes sounds from the 40s to the modern day.
Mm. All right, so we have some clips from the Watkins archive. Let's give a listen to a few. First, we have a walrus. What can you tell us about that?
So there's a sound where if you first heard that, you'd probably think that you're listening to something rather mechanical. Mm-hmm. And the strange thing about the walrus, male walrus during the breeding season inflate a sac in their body and they strike it with a bone, and that makes that gong-like sound. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge diversity of sounds that animals make, and marine mammals have specialized in developing new sound production mechanisms that work well underwater.
All right, next we have a recording of a bearded seal. Where are these animals found?
So ice-loving seals in both the Antarctic and the Arctic will produce, again, males will produce complicated songs during the breeding season. And this is an example of a sound produced by an Arctic seal.
Almost sounds like something from a sci-fi movie, doesn't it?
Exactly.
That's why they got the track.
Yeah, this is one of the wild things about doing this kind of work is when you are in the exploration mode and you first put your hydrophone in the water, you really have no idea what sounds are going to come out of the ocean. And we hear the recording here. It's much more moving and surprising when you're bouncing around on a boat and hearing this coming out of an actual environment.
It's almost like a little bit of detective work, isn't it? You hear this sound, then you got to figure out what it is, how it's made, why the animal is making that sound, right?
Yes, and the early phase of marine mammal bioacoustics, which Scheville and Watkins really excelled in, was this ability to identify what sound was made by what species. And there's a terrible track record of lots of people making bad associations because you're on a boat, you see an animal, you hear a sound, mm-hmm. you're not that careful. And they really excelled in being super careful and conservative about being sure that a sound was made by the particular animal, particular species.
All right, let's hear another recording of a seal. This is the Ross seal. Are these found in Antarctica as well?
Yes.
Okay, let's take a listen. Again, that sounds like similar, right, to the bearded seal. So how do you know which one is which? How do you?
Yeah, so the polar ice-loving seals make these really complicated kinds of signals, and it takes careful analysis. So Bob was mentioning the ear that Watkins had for languages. It takes a similar ear for being able to encode sounds that aren't familiar to us and be able to detect subtle differences to sort out what's going on. Nowadays, again, we can rely on computers to help us, but the ear, the human ear, is the most sophisticated analysis we have.
All right, Bob, you're on the boat with Bill. He's doing this work. What was that like? I mean, you know, as he collects a sound like this, what was happening on the boat?
Well, everybody will romanticize it, I think, and they'll think about how wonderful and exciting it is to be a marine mammal scientist. They're out there chasing whales around and up close and personal with them. But the fact is that I'd say there's 90% of it is tedium.
Mm.
There's just a lot of time spent watching and listening and waiting for something to happen. And a good example of that is one year, I think, down around Dominica, there weren't any whales around. There was no sound. And the reason we learned later was because there was an invasion going on in Grenada. And as a result, because of that, in support of that, there were a lot of submarines around making a lot of noise, using their sonars to make a lot of noise. So sometimes it was, very fulfilling work. And in particular, I don't know if we have time, but I could tell the story. Well, It's difficult to describe, but with the boat, you just imagine approaching a boat, approaching a sperm whale that you've been tracking for maybe hours. You pick one out of a group, and then we make our approach. There's a lot of protocols involved up to the moment that you actually shoot the tag. But if you reach that point, in this particular one, there was a lone bull near us. And we made the approach, and it was a good one, and at the last moment, Bill said okay, and the gunner, Romain, he fired the tag, and it struck the whale right about at the water level, just at the right spot. Now, the boat, if you imagine, the boat is just about stopped at this point, and we're just slowly drifting by the whale, and I can't do anything now. We're stopped. The engine shut down. I went over to the wheelhouse window, and I looked down, down right beside the boat to starboard, and just underwater, I could see this entire full 45-50-foot long sperm whale had rolled over on his side, and he was looking at me.
Oh, my.
We had eye contact. And he sort of said, "I'll remember you." And he just, I could see him underwater. He just sort of folded in half and went straight down. Now, at the same moment, we had towed arrays that were our transducers that we now threw overboard so we could receive the signal. And Kurt Fristrup came up in the wheelhouse, and he started interrogating the tag. And the initial reaction was that, oh, something's gone wrong. The tag has fallen out. It's gone to the bottom. And I turned on the depth sounder, and I looked at the chart. We had 6,000 feet of water under us, and that's where the tag went. Mm. But about 45 minutes later, it started coming back up.
Wow.
And so what we learned was that that whale had gone from the surface directly to 6,000 feet without even hyperventilating and stayed down there for 45 minutes.
Wow.
Came up about a mile away, 1,500 feet, stayed there for another 15 minutes, and then surfaced, and we could see the tag. And that was a day of elation,
moment, yeah.
Wasn't it,
yeah.
Peter?
Yes.
Yeah.
And as we've developed the tagging work, we've now really been able to understand the life of these deep-diving toothed whales that can hold their breath for up to 2 hours. They can dive to thousands of meters. And we can actually track in many of these species, like the beaked whales you heard in the very beginning. You can often hear echoes from their own clicks of prey. And you can get the whale version of a fish finder as they're actually tracking and finding prey in the dark, mm-hmm. 1,000 meters below the sea surface.
Yeah. You brought up a good point, Bob, about the tedium, which is true of any kind of research. You know, there's a lot of work and a lot of, you know, kind of dull times, if you will, that go into that till you get to that exciting moment, which I think in a lot of ways makes it that much more exciting, right? When something like that finally happens.
You certainly look forward to for the action. I have a clip. I've been going through Bill's logs for this talk I'm doing, and in him I found a note from Amy Samuels, and Amy was one of our observers, one of the scientists who worked with Bill, and in her log she made note of nothing happening for a very, very long time.
But I would like to pick up, I think that this part of this work, it only works if you have the personality where you're also ready to wait for things. So, I mean, one of the points here is that you have to be prepared for what you can't anticipate. So if you're not the kind of person who looks forward to a day when you wake up and you look forward to having no idea what that day is going to bring for you, and it might be something really wonderful, and if you're also not completely prepared for the opportunities that you may find, you wouldn't get results here. The key here is these animals live in a world that's so foreign to us.
Well,
we need high technology to get access. So it's partly waiting and partly exploring, but you have to be a very prepared explorer.
Yeah.
Well, I on that point, I remember one night. Now, Bill and I would often be up first because we'd have to make decisions on weather, and often up late, he'd be repairing his equipment. And sometimes the enthusiasm of these guys, like Peter and Kurt in particular, you know, and others I remember, they wanted to stay up all night while we were at anchor, recording snapping shrimp or whatever, you mm-hmm. know. And I can remember Bill. I'd learned some lessons about crew management. Mm-hmm. And Bill would tell them to go to bed because he needed them tomorrow. Because it might be the next day they would get a tag in that we would then want to follow and track for the next 24 hours.
Yeah.
So he wanted his people ready.
Well, you mentioned a sperm whale. We actually have a recording of a sperm whale. Let's take a listen. Sperm whales were hunted to near extinction. How are their numbers today?
They have come back to some extent with lack of hunting, and they're global animals. So they're animals that I think are less at risk than species like a river dolphin or coastal porpoises that live in habitats that are more impacted by humans and live in local environments where they're vulnerable to our choices there.
We also have a recording of pilot whales. Before we hear it, how did they get their name?
Pilot whales, I think, were basically named this because they came up to ships as they came into harbors, and they were viewed as like a pilot vessel to help bring them into the harbor.
Very different than the tapping we've heard like with the sperm whale.
Yeah, huh? So the sperm whale produces a very loud click for echolocation to find their prey and to orient in the deep ocean. But they also then have adapted that to make those resonant rhythmic patterns of clicks, da 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 da, kind of sound that you heard repeated several times. And they use that for communication. The dolphins use these tonal signals that are then modulated like melodies to communicate sound.
We are talking about the pioneer work of William Watkins, who opened our ears to the ocean. In studio with us is Captain Bob Wallace, who ran the research vessel Able J, a platform for much of Bill Watkins' early work, and Peter Tyack, scientist emeritus in the biology department at HUI, who studies social behavior. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the pioneering work of William Watkins, who opened our ears to the ocean. With us is Captain Bob Wallace, who ran the research vessel Able J, which was the platform for much of Bill Watkins' early work. Also with us is Peter Tyack, scientist emeritus in the biology department at HUI, who studies social behavior and acoustic communication in marine mammals. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Peter, explain how scientists decipher what particular vocalizations mean and how technology has developed to help researchers in that, deciphering that.
So one very important thing for us is when we put our head underwater, I don't know if when you're swimming you've been aware of this, you can hear a sound, it almost sounds like it's in your head. You can't localize the sound very well. The mechanisms we use to locate sounds in air don't work. So you require something like this array of hydrophones to use a computer to localize sounds. And Watkins and Chaville, for example, with the sperm whales, found that when you do localization, each individual sperm whale will often produce a series of these rhythmic sounds, like the rhythmic click sounds that you heard. And they published early papers on individually distinctive ones. As we follow the click sounds over time, you can find that different groups tend to produce different codas as well. Mm. So by slowly making observation of which sounds individuals make in which contexts, which sounds groups make, and expanding that over large areas, we can start to sort out function. So now we know that sperm whales, for example, have dialects over very large areas of ocean. So most of the sperm whales in the Mediterranean, for example, have one rhythmic series of clicks they make that's different from the ones in the North Atlantic.
Wow. So what do we know about how marine mammals learn to communicate? Do we know if it's similar how language develops in people?
Yes. So most mammals don't learn their sounds. If your dog would imitate a tune that you were saying, you would be very surprised. But marine mammals are unusual among mammals for being able to learn sounds like we do. So with dolphins, they can be played back a tonal kind of sound, like one of our melodies, and they can learn to imitate it and produce it back to us. They learn to produce the sounds that they hear in their own life. So, for example, if we compare the sounds of captive dolphins who hear the trainer's whistle, a whistle, just a tweet that the trainer uses to tell the animals they've done the right thing, young bottlenose dolphins raised in captivity have very flat tweet-like elements of their whistles that we don't record in the wild because it's a novel part of their acoustic environment.
Right, we have more recordings from Watkins Archive. Let's hear two different recordings of a beluga whale. Here's the first one. What can you tell us about that?
So again, you should be able to hear there, even though we don't know how to parse it, the same sound repeated over and over several times. So by being able to hear sequences, that helps you categorize sounds, even with your own ear, and then ask the question, well, what was the situation? Was that animal foraging? Was it resting? What was the context in which it was made? And people then slowly can build up a catalog of sounds to look at the context.
Here's a second one. That's very different.
Yes. So there what we're hearing is echolocation sounds. Those are not sounds used for communication. The animal's probably actually echolocating on the underwater microphone or hydrophone in order to sort of figure out what that is, listening for echoes from the microphone.
Killer whales travel in pods and hunt together. Do we know if they use vocalizations to communicate about prey or hunting strategies?
Yes, we don't know the details about the context in which they produce the calls as well as we do know difference about the group-specific calls. So each pod or group of killer whales has a group-specific repertoire of complicated calls that sounds sort of like those pilot whale calls, and they can identify the group by listening to the repertoire of calls that are made.
Let's take a listen.
So there you can hear calls near, calls far. The animals in that group can maintain contact with each other, even when they separate over kilometers. And if another group were present, came by, they'd be able to tell that it was a different group by listening to that repertoire of
Interesting.
Them.
So humans are creating a good deal of noise pollution in the oceans. Shipping traffic, especially when it gets concentrated in coastal waters, creates a lot of noise. In New England, shipping lanes are often located near feeding areas for marine animals. So how are the whales adapting to that?
Yes, there's a complicated pattern of compensating for noise that all birds and mammals use. But noise is everywhere present in the natural world, including the noises that we make. And so animals have adapted mechanisms so that when it gets louder, they just call louder in order to be able to maintain the range over which they need to communicate. So when the noise of a ship comes from a ship going by, a whale may adapt its call to call louder in order to maintain a contact with, say, a calf, mother and calf behavior. Another element that happens is the shipping noise is actually quite low in frequency. And because of having a long time base of recordings of calls, Susan Parks was able to compare the calls of animals like right whales when Cape Cod Bay was relatively quiet in the 50s and today. And she's found that as the low frequency noise became louder, the whales actually shifted from being basses to being tenors. They increased the frequency of their call to get out of the noise channel.
That is amazing, isn't it? Wow.
So it means that in order to describe what the sounds are like, we also have to give as background what was the noise when the call was recorded. How noisy was it? What was the frequency range of the noise?
And, of course, North Atlantic right whales are a critically endangered species, often the victim of ship strikes. So we know that they're in the shipping areas. We have a recording that compares the vocalizations of right whales before an increase in shipping traffic that you're talking about. So what are we listening for here?
So this is a contact call that's made by right whales that are when they're separated to maintain contact with one another. So it's very important to be able to maintain communication over the range of separation.
Wow.
So you should have been able to hear that there's a bass call and a tenor call. Just to the human ear, we can hear those differences. And with computers now, it's quite easy to measure what are the frequency ranges of the calls and how does that energy shift as a function of exposure to noise.
Human-generated noise in the oceans is on the rise. Offshore wind farms are being constructed. The Steamship Authority is constructing a new dock and terminal here in Woods Hole. We feel that the pile driving here in the building right here. So for construction projects like that and the offshore wind farms that are being planned, do we know if animals will leave when the noise is too great like that? And then do they return? Do we have any kind of data on that impact?
Yes, it depends on the species that you're concerned about. And there's been a lot of development of offshore wind farms in European waters. They're ahead of us in this area. And harbor porpoise are very common in areas like the North Sea where they've constructed wind farms. And research there has shown that harbor porpoise will avoid piling for the construction of wind farms by about 10 to 20 kilometers. Mm. So it causes a big avoidance of the habitat. And it means that if you're planning doing this, you need to do it to organize the planning in a way that avoidance doesn't harm the ability of harbor porpoise to feed.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands, excuse me, .org. Are there species of sound researchers have yet to capture? Is there something on your list that you'd still like to find?
Well, an example of recent knowledge came from these animals, the beaked whales, which produce clicks that when you have a tag on the animal, we can hear it to our own ear. But when you're far away, they're so high in frequency, it would be like the calls of bats that we can't hear without that. So we have to be able to use specialized gear to be able to record high-frequency sounds. And at this point, because of being able to have recordings like Danielle made where we identify the calls, we now can actually track with animals that are hard to see what species are present. Mm. So if you know the sounds true beaked whales make, then even though you can't see them, if you're towing the hydrophone, you may be able to conduct a census to find them.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's like birds. You can hear them maybe and you can't see them. Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So what regulations are in place for human-induced sound in the oceans, and how can we improve protections for marine mammals that are impacted by that noise?
In the U.S., the Marine Mammal Protection Act prohibits harassing animals or disturbing them, and there are rules that establish what levels of sound exposure are likely to cause this kind of disturbance. But there's a lot of variability in how animals respond to particular sounds and how different species respond. So, for example, I mentioned the harbor porpoise avoid piling at great distances. Beaked whales show very strong responses to naval sonar at great ranges. And for both of those species, we've adopted new rules that have lower thresholds for harassment than for other species. But there are many other cases like this where we have to be sure that the rules that we're applying actually are appropriate for the activity that we're putting into the ocean and for the species that are present.
I would think it's quite a challenge then, because as we're learning more and we've got this data to show that maybe it's having more of an impact than we thought, changing regulation is not as easy as it sounds, right?
Yes, and this is an area where science is moving very rapidly, and once a regulation's in place, actually changing it is very difficult.
Yeah. Bill Watkins and his collaborators' recordings gave the public a window into this world of marine mammals. Bob, do you remember how the public responded when these recordings were first shared outside of the research community?
Do I remember? No, I don't.
Because I
wasn't really in that world, you know. Yeah. I was a boat captain.
You were
scientist.
Just sort of on the sidelines. What about
That's
you,
right.
Peter? What do you think?
Yes. Well, I vividly remember when the songs of the humpbacked whale
were put
out on a recording for people to listen to. And that was a contribution where Chaville and Watkins had a science focus. Roger Payne was both a cellist and a scientist, and he recognized the musical qualities of the sound and realized that many of us, would just as humans, would love listening to these sounds just like we like listening to the dawn chorus of songbirds in the spring.
Yeah. What do you think the long-term impact of these recordings is on marine mammal conservation?
I think it's very important for us to be able to understand the animals through our own experience, like the experience we will have listening to Humpback Song. It's also very important for being able to census the animals. Once we know what sounds they make in an area of the ocean that's very hard to see the animals, we can use the sounds in order to estimate how many there are and how they may be reacting to sound.
Mm. Bob, you're going to be giving a talk about the research vessel Abel J and tales about the voyages towards the ends of the earth at the New Bedford Whaling Museum Thursday, March 21st, 6:30. And we're going to have more details about that on our website. But the collection at the New Bedford Whaling Museum is quite interesting. And I want your thoughts on that first. And then, Peter, why don't you talk about the importance of curating that?
Well, the whole collection, it's been around for a long time, but originally the old Dartmouth Historical Society, and its focus was on whaling history. But in the last 20 years or more, you know, it could have happened earlier, but the collection was combined with the Kendall Museum from Sharon. And along with the Kendall collection came an entire collection of logbooks and artwork, and scrimshaw in particular, that was combined with the collection of now the Whaling Museum, New Bedford Whaling Museum. So all of that stuff together with archives of Bill and Bill Chevelle's and Bill Watkins' acoustic recordings is all there now, and they have an exhibit going on at the museum that features their work. So my talk next week is about the Abel J and its connection with Bill Watkins in particular, but sort of about the evolution of the Abel J and how it came about and some of the work that we did with it.
Yeah. All right, Peter, curating this data. It's not easy to find somebody to do that.
No, and we're in this very interesting situation where the New Bedford Whaling Museum, a lot of its history was built on the pride of the captains who built wooden ships in New England, sailed over the entire globe, well, in their view, harvesting whales as a resource, which provided a lot of economic growth for New England. But in the last 50 years, we've had a radical change of how we view whales. And I think it's really important that the Whaling Museum has a broader view now and is viewing its role as understanding the human relationships to whales, whether it was hunting whales or studying them, as we've described. And they've recognized that in the modern science environment, where most of the science research money goes towards innovation and developing new ways to study, it's actually very hard to curate data in a way that that preserves it over time. I mentioned how important those recordings of the right whale calls from the 50s were for understanding the impact of noise on whales. In many ways, these data are extremely important. As climate change changes the oceans, the kinds of observations that explorers like Watkins and Chevelle have made in the ocean, the records they have are critical for our understanding of the ocean. And having an organization like the Whaling Museum take on data and scientific instrumentation to curate, like they've curated the earlier whaling information, is both really important culturally for understanding our relationship to the animals, but it also preserves data that will be really important for understanding how we've changed the ocean over time.
We wouldn't know about the change in the right whale's vocalizations, would we, if we didn't have those early recordings?
No, yeah. And the media change constantly, so it takes constant effort and constant curation to take this kind of data and make sure that it's available for future generations.
Bob Wallace and Peter Tighe, thanks so much for coming in. Really fascinating stuff here today.
Thanks for having
us. Our pleasure.
Yeah. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.